From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Louis Farrakhan appoints the convicted killer of Malcolm X to head Malcolm's historic Harlem Mosque. Also, Sierra Club members debate whether to pass an anti-immigrant referendum, and a preview of the Jericho 98 March to free U.S. political prisoners. We'll speak with the first African-American ever convicted of seditious conspiracy, the mother of two Puerto Rican jailed independence activists, and legendary peace activist Dave Dellinger. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Bill Clinton is the first American president to visit South Africa. He arrived in Cape Town early this morning with little fanfare and has spent the night resting in his hotel. Clinton will be officially welcomed from South Africa's President Nelson Mandela and will then address Parliament. A spokesperson says Clinton's speech will be a celebration of South Africa's peaceful transition from apartheid to majority rule democracy. Some South African groups want Clinton to continue the expressions of regret that have marked his trip to Africa. The South African Communist Party said he should apologize for U.S. support of African dictators and apartheid, while the campaign to ban landmines said he should promise that no U.S. mines would be used in Africa. Another group wanted him to end the embargo against Cuba. The communists also said the United States should make a submission to South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission on the U.S. role during the apartheid era. Indeed, American civil rights leader Jesse Jackson, traveling with Clinton, said the United States was involved certainly indirectly with the apartheid regime because, quote, we saw the apartheid Afrikaners as our geopolitical partners within our own country. We fought mightily to change that relationship, and at the end, our country was the most effective in helping them with their transition. But Clinton was unlikely to respond to the various demands and requests by such groups. Mike McCurry, press secretary for President Clinton, said Clinton's speech to the parliament would be an ode to the historic transformation in South Africa, but he was vague on specifics. When asked whether there were matters that Clinton could express regrets about, McCurry replied, "We haven't gotten around to apartheid yet." Clinton was to spend 4 days in South Africa, the only state visit of his 12-day tour of Africa. He'll spend Friday with Mandela in meetings and touring the former island prison where Mandela was held for 18 years before traveling to Johannesburg to dedicate a commercial center named for the late Commerce Secretary Ron Brown. As he traversed Africa this week, President Clinton repeatedly spoke in apologetic tones about past U.S. policy there. In his opening address in Ghana, he said America was wrong to turn a blind eye to Africa's neglect for so long. In Uganda, Clinton nearly apologized for slavery, saying U.S. demand for labor wrongfully propped up the slave trade. And in Rwanda, he told genocide survivors that the United States should have been more vigilant in stopping the slaughter of more than 500,000 people in 1994.
All over the world, there were people like me sitting in offices day after day after day who did not fully appreciate the depth and the speed with which you were being engulfed by this unimaginable terror.
The Clinton administration had shied from using the word genocide because some might have invoked the 1948 genocide treaty's demand for action. Rakia Omar of the London-based Africa Rights says it's not, as President Clinton said, a matter of lack of information.
By pretending that what was happening was not happening, I think the administration hoped it could wriggle out of its moral and political responsibilities. They could have intervened and I think would have stopped the genocide.
And this news from the former Yugoslavia. The United States failed to obtain backing from allies on new sanctions to punish Yugoslavia for its violent crackdown in Kosovo province. But Russia promised to support a United Nations resolution for a comprehensive arms embargo on the government of President Slobodan Milosevic. Richard Butler, the chief United Nations arms inspector for Iraq, told the government of Saddam Hussein that inspections of 8 previously forbidden presidential properties would begin tomorrow under the direction of an American, Charles Dulfer, whom the Iraqis have accused of being a spy. British authorities said in statements intended to keep the Northern Ireland peace talks on track that they had no evidence that several recent bombings were the work of the Irish Republican Army. But they added that three bombings in the last 2 months in which no one was killed but that caused substantial property damage were probably carried out by members of IRA dissident groups. And this news from Georgia. Friday was Coke Day at Greenbrier High School in Evans, Georgia. Yesterday was Mike Cameron Day nationwide. Cameron is the 19-year-old senior who was suspended for 1 day yesterday for wearing a Pepsi shirt at a Coke Day rally at his school. Instead of attending classes, he spent much of his day talking to the national media and participating in call-in shows about his plight. Listeners to Democracy Now! May remember our conversation just a few days ago on the issue of commercialism in the schools. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to all of our listeners out there across the country.
Well, I think that was an interesting story, this last one, on this young man, the young man in Georgia who decided to wear a Pepsi t-shirt on Coke Day. It very much followed up on our discussions with the activists in San Francisco who've been fighting commercialism in the schools.
Well, it sounds at least quite a number of students still have independent minds, regardless of the bombardment of advertisements.
Well, we're going to talk about another issue right now. Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan has appointed Muhammad Abdul Aziz, one of three men convicted of assassinating Malcolm X in 1965, as captain in charge of Mosque No. 7, the historic Harlem Temple headed by Malcolm X before his murder. We're joined right now by Peter Noel. He's a reporter for The Village Voice, which is a weekly alternative newspaper in New York. And he broke the story yesterday in the latest issue of The Village Voice in a piece called Farrakhan Hires a Convicted Killer of Malcolm X. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Peter Noel.
Good morning, Amy and Ron.
Well, why don't you start off by just telling us the facts of this latest appointment?
Well, pretty much it's a story that we got a hold of through sources within the Nation of Islam. I sat on the story for like 5 days, and actually I was stunned trying to digest what the minister had done. You know, my feelings about Malcolm X and my emotions, my conflicting emotions as to whether or not Mr. Farrakhan was involved, all of that came into play. And pretty much what I learned then was that the minister had appointed Aziz, to actually come in as the captain. Now, you have to understand something about the hierarchical structure. Farrakhan has been reorganizing, Mosque No. 7, the East Coast region, trying to make New York City again the heartbeat of the Nation of Islam. You know, all of the other mosques are subordinate to Mosque No. 2, which is in Chicago. He wants to come back and make New York City, viable again, make the mosque, the apple of the Nation of Islam's eye. And in doing so, he brought back, Ben Chavis, who was the former executive director of the NAACP. Of course, he was involved in a sex scandal, and he went on to help organize the Million Man March. Farrakhan rehabilitated him, and Chavis took the name Benjamin F. Muhammad. So it's part of this whole process, a part of preparations, we understand, for the 2000, in which Farrakhan will lead another, the fifth anniversary of the Million Man March back to Washington, D.C. So what he has done here is brought in, Aziz, who is actually, they describe as a military genius, who was also a former member of the Fruit of Islam, which is the Black Muslim Elite Guard. And he brought Aziz in to actually help reorganize the Fruit of Islam in the East Coast region. And Aziz will actually train these men, for Allah, as Farrakhan says. So he brought Aziz into Mosque No. 7. And that is where the controversy lies, because this is the mosque that Malcolm X actually headed. And some people believe it's an insult to the memory of Malcolm X that the minister would do this.
But, Peter, for those who are not familiar with some of the details of Malcolm's assassination and the trial that occurred after that, Aziz has always maintained that he was innocent of the charges, hasn't he? Could you explain a little bit about what happened? And there's been even some very prominent progressive activists have sided with him over the years, like Bill Kunstler. Could you tell us a little bit about that history, the details of what happened in the assassination?
Well, you know, of course, I mean, it would be too long to actually go into everything, but the fine points are, is that, of course, during the trial, you know, there were actually three men who were arrested for the killing of the assassination of Malcolm X on February 21st, 1965. They were known then as Thomas Hagen, Thomas Johnson, and Norman Truex Butler. Hagen, I mean, during the trial, actually, you know, reversed his whole innocence and said that he was responsible. He took part in actually killing Malcolm X. The other two, which is Aziz now and Islam Johnson, they were not involved. But of course, you know, that sort of hurt, you know, the case against Aziz and Islam, which is, again, Norman Butler and Johnson, because he comes out at a time and he looked as if he was trying to protect these guys. They were convicted. All three of them were convicted. Norman Butler spent like 19 years in prison. The facts of the case...
Well, let me interrupt you one second now. Isn't it also true that Hagen said that he was not a Muslim.
He was not a Muslim.
And that he was part of a group of three other men?
That, right. Yeah, I'm coming to that. Yeah, he said he was not a Muslim. He was paid money, you know, to carry out the murder. He also named four guys, you know, four other people who he said were involved in planning and carrying out the assassination. Well, I mean, of course, there's a lot of questions as to why, you know, Butler and Johnson were there at that time. How Butler and Johnson wound up, you know, to be injured and one to be shot. And all these questions remain. Now, I believe at this time, and I mean, because I'm a student of history, and because I've read and I've tried to study this this mystery, I believe that the NOI, the FBI, and the CIA, and other domestic intelligence organizations were involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. You know, Louis Farrakhan said, you know, he helped to create the atmosphere. Along the line, the NOI played a massive role in actually bringing about this man's death. I mean, yes, people regret that now. I know there's a lot of regret within the Nation of Islam, but then again, there's a lot of people within the Nation of Islam who believe that Malcolm got what he deserved for actually going out there and saying that, actually telling the world that Elijah Muhammad, the man who many blacks held in high esteem, was actually sleeping with his secretaries and had father children with them. So that you know, that whole atmosphere there, that's the atmosphere in which Malcolm was killed. And as far as the prominent people actually coming out and saying that they don't believe that Aziz and Islam were involved in the thing, yes, this is maybe an informed opinion. These are some of the things that some people latched onto. You had William Buckley, the right-wing, you know, conservative commentator. All of these people were involved. W. Dean Muhammad, this is from a rival Muslim organization. All of them, you know, believed that these two people were scapegoats. Fine. I mean, that's the belief. I believe at that point in time, today, there is not enough evidence, you know, for a new generation of youngsters who revere Malcolm X, who love Malcolm X, and also who love and respect Minister Farrakhan. There is not enough evidence for them to think otherwise, because they believe that the people who were convicted of assassinating Malcolm X are the ones responsible.
Well, isn't part of the problem in terms of digging up the full information? Clearly, COINTELPRO and the FBI were very active in those days. And I remember, for instance, one of Malcolm's bodyguards, wasn't it Gene Roberts, who was working with the Bureau of Special Services, the Police Intelligence Unit at the time. And he was there the night that Malcolm was killed. But I'd like to ask you, Betty Shabazz, apparently toward the latter end of her life before she died last summer, opposed reopening the investigation, didn't she, or taking a new look into it?
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, for Betty, I mean, it was a very emotional thing for her. I had spoken to Betty Shabazz, you know, many years, I mean, somewhere around like 79 or 80, and, you know, when I was trying to do an interview on that, and she said, look, I wouldn't even do this. You know, she had written a manuscript that she could never get published because no one wanted to actually read what she wanted to say about her husband and her life then. Remember, she was there at that time. She was pregnant with twins when this happened, and it would just have opened up another wound for her, that old wound, and she didn't want it.
And do you think that this appointment coming now, very soon after Betty Shabazz's death, that Louis Farrakhan actually waited until she died to appoint Aziz, not only to head the Harlem Mosque No. 7, but also to be the East Coast representative?
Yeah, and then coming again, just less than 6 months, Amy, after Betty Shabazz died, it appears to be, you know, some people an insult, you know, that he would do this. I mean, you know, yes, she's dead, and then life must go on. Most people believe that it's an insult to her memory. Most people believe it's an insult to the people of Harlem. Most people believe it's an insult to the memory of Malcolm X. But then again, most people believe, like David Dinkins, I was very surprised to hear the mayor, former mayor, say, look, you know, Aziz served his time, and I will leave the judgment as to whether or not it was insensitive to other people to make that. But I think the mayor took a middle road. And again, I would, in a sense too, I would say yes. You know, yes, Aziz served this time, and he was paroled, and he may serve, I mean, you know, in some great capacity to, you know, helping a generation of young men, you know, get off drugs and try to clean them up, you know. But then again, you know, there's a lot of questions to be answered. I know I ended my piece by saying, make it plain, Brother Minister. I think that Farrakhan, you know, has to come out at some point and said, you know, talk about the role that he played in creating the atmosphere that led to Malcolm's death. He must do this for this generation of youngsters who are asking a lot of provocative questions.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much, Peter Noel, for joining us. Again, Peter Noel, a reporter who did a breaking story in the Village Voice this week called Farrakhan Hires a Convicted Killer of Malcolm X. Make it plain, Brother Minister, by Peter Noel. Thanks for being with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a little while, we're going to talk about the Jericho 98 March, which is going to be taking place in Washington tomorrow, a march to free U.S. political prisoners. But right now, we're going to turn to another issue, an issue about the environment and population. Members of the Sierra Club are currently voting on a referendum on whether to adopt a policy advocating a reduction in U.S. immigration. Called the Comprehensive Population Policy, the initiative would reverse an earlier decision by the Sierra Club to take no position on U.S. government immigration policy. The new initiative is sponsored by members of the group who were angered by the earlier no position decision. They gathered more than 1,000 member signatures to put the question to a vote. Alan Cooper is one of those who is pressing for the Sierra Club to take a stand on immigration, to reduce immigration in this country. He's a retired professor of engineering at Case Western Reserve University and chair of the Population Environment Committee of the Ohio chapter of the Sierra Club. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alan Cooper. Before our break, why don't you just lay out for us what this referendum is that now thousands of Sierra Club members are voting on by mail now until April 18th.
Well, it's quite simple. But first, let me say that, you know, we all in the Sierra Club share the same values concerning a healthy world and preservation of the natural world. And Carl and I work together. We're friends. But this is a very fundamental question. There's no question that the United States has too many people, and we can't remain silent in the face of a runaway population growth. You know, the U.S. is paved over, dumped on, filled in, built in, cut over, smogged in, drained down, fished out. You just read that in the news every day. We pave over an area the size of the entire state of Delaware every year now. And there's no way that this can be sustained. We act as if there were no children. And it isn't just all of us here, all of us and our children. No person, nothing anywhere in the world should want our population to grow. We're the principal reason their climate is changing. And the U.S. is growing far faster than any other large industrial nation, 3 million a year. That's the size of almost any large city, a mega city in this country. There are only New York and L.A. and Chicago are bigger. And we had a baby boom. Our population doubled since World War II. That's why we have these environmental problems. Now that's over. Now we're in an immigration boom, and our population is going to double again, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, in less than 70 years. And incredibly, no one is talking about this, not in Washington. Washington should be talking not just about Social Security, but for the future, natural security. And, you know, the United States has no population policy. And population policy now is immigration policy. And the Sierra Club has to tell the facts of the limits to what nature provides. We can't remain silent, and the Sierra Club members are voting on this. That's what we're talking about. But, you know, the Sierra Club has already won, because here we are today telling it like it is, and that's our goal.
Alan Cooper, we're going to get a response from Carl Pope, the executive director of the Sierra Club, when we come back from our break. Alan Cooper, chair of the Population Environment Committee of the Ohio chapter of the Sierra Club, one of the members pushing for a position for the Sierra Club to take on reduction in U.S. immigration. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we continue this discussion on immigration that the Sierra Club is having right now. Actually, Sierra Club members around the country, 500,000 people, are voting now in mail-in ballots on a referendum on whether to adopt a policy advocating a reduction in U.S. immigration. We've just been listening to Alan Cooper, who is one of those who is pressing for this referendum. Carl Pope is also with us, executive director of the Sierra Club. He represents the position of the board of directors of Sierra Club in opposing this referendum. Carl Pope, can you explain exactly how it's worded and why you oppose it?
Well, thank you very much, and it's good to be with you this morning. To begin with, I want to urge everybody who might be listening who is a Sierra Club member to vote, because while we have mailed out ballots to more than 500,000 people, in most of our elections where we're only electing candidates for our board of directors, we don't have that high a turnout. And I would really like to urge all of your listeners, even if they decide they don't know enough about the candidates for board of directors, to vote for those, although I hope they do that too. But at least do vote on this issue, because I think it is extremely fundamental and extremely important. Not only the board of directors, but the grassroots leadership of the Sierra Club believes that the Sierra Club cannot protect America's environment by getting into U.S. immigration policy. Because U.S. immigration policy is a symptom, U.S. immigration levels are a symptom, not a cause of our real problems. Globally, we do have overpopulation. Alan Cooper just said the United States is overpopulated, a statement I agree with. I think he would have to agree that Britain, France, Italy, Japan, India, Guatemala, Mexico, and China, among dozens and dozens of countries, are at least as overpopulated as the United States. The reality is overpopulation is a symptom of such global problems as overpopulation, environmental destruction, human rights abuses, and we need to deal with the symptoms, with the causes. We can't just focus on this symptom. Limiting population immigration in the United States is not going to stop timber companies from cutting down our ancient forests. It's not going to make Detroit put fuel efficiency technology on its cars and sport utility vehicles. It's not going to clean up our remaining water supply. It's not going to bring down U.S. birth rates. The United States has the highest levels of teenage pregnancy in the industrial world. The United States has the highest levels of unplanned pregnancy in the industrial world. And when Alan says we've solved the rest of the population problem, he seems to be ignoring the fact that we have more unplanned pregnancies in the United States every year than we have immigrants, 1.3 million versus approximately 1 million. So we have some very fundamental root causes of our environmental and overpopulation problem, and the Sierra Club needs to concentrate its energy on dealing with those root causes. we can't say to the rest of the world, look, we're going to sit here in the United States in first class, and the Titanic is going down, but as long as there aren't too many of us here, we can get in the lifeboats and get off, because the reality is there are no lifeboats off Spaceship Earth. We are all in the environmental crisis together, as we recently saw highlighted so vividly in the Kyoto Summit on Global Climate Change. And we need, as a nation and as a world, to be dealing with our contribution, our local contribution, to the world's environmental crisis. And our local contribution consists of too high fertility rates. It consists of irresponsible corporations that are destroying not only the environment here in the United States, but in many other countries as well. And it consists in a lifestyle that in many cases is unsustainable at any level of Americans.
Mr. Cooper, I'd like to ask you, in terms of what Karl Popp has said, would you respond to that? And also, would you respond to the issue of the general question of overpopulation? Clearly, there are many places even in the industrial world, Western Europe and Japan, who have a much greater population density than the United States. And even just on bare population terms, why do you insist that comparatively they don't have as much of the pollution and environmental problems that we do? Could you respond to that also?
Yes, you know, this really takes a lot of thought on the part of each of us. If you were going to essentially solve the world's environmental problems and you had a single move to make, the country that you would want to have stop population growth above all others would be, as a matter of fact, all others combined, would be the single country, the United States. We contribute one quarter of the pollution that goes out over the world that causes climate change. We are the place where you would want to level off your rapid population growth more than any other. And that's why it's so important. And as a matter of fact, the Sierra Club long ago recognized this. It says to stabilize population as soon as possible, first in the United States. And we know a great deal more now. We know, for instance, we are by far the greatest contributor to shredding the protective stratospheric ozone layer. Now, this argument that unplanned pregnancies, that teen pregnancies, that is taking our eye off the ball. The U.S. Census Bureau projection tells us that as our population now doubles, and you know, we've done that. We know what happens when you double your population. We know what happens to everything. We're going to double again, and that is due 80% to immigrants and their descendants. The fact is that the resident population, when the baby boom ended, the resident population of 1970, the Census Bureau looks at those figures and says, on average, in spite of all this stuff about teen pregnancy and so forth, on average, the United States couples are only having two children. So the other point that Carl made about irresponsible corporations, absolutely, that's what this is really about. The Sierra Club, our work, the environmental movement, we are always up against the forces of greed. You ask yourself, who is driving these high immigration rates and the sweatshops, the agribusiness? We are up against the same forces that we always are, and that's why, of course, we should be working on this.
Well, can I respond? I guess
Carl Pope, executive director of Sierra
Club. That last point, I guess I would clearly, if what Alan was talking about was that we should not allow American corporations to forcibly import people to the United States as we did in the era of slavery, I think that is an immigration policy reform we could all agree about. The reality is, people don't come to the United States because American corporations abduct them. They do come to the United States in many cases because American corporations destroy their livelihoods. Since the United States and Mexico signed NAFTA, 400,000 Mexican agricultural families have been driven off the land in rural Mexico by the policy set in place by NAFTA. Many of those people will probably end up being forced to migrate to the United States. The Sierra Club's grassroots leadership and the Sierra Club Board of Directors completely agrees that the Sierra Club should do everything it can to make it possible for those people to remain in their homes. Most people around the world want to remain home. They don't want to migrate. They're forced to migrate. And the policy alternative B, which the Sierra Club grassroots and board of directors are supporting, calls for the club to focus its energy on dealing with those forces which compel people away from their homes, but to do so by enabling them to remain home, not by saying, let's put these people into the global migration stream, which is 100 million people, 100 times migration to the United States, and then say, well, you can go anywhere but the United States. We don't think that's the right approach. We don't think that sends the right message to the world. We don't think that addresses the root causes of our problem. And I guess with regard to teenage pregnancy, I mean, I will simply state that, yes, it's true that a lot of our population growth will be the result of people born to people who came to this country since 1970. An even larger part, of course, is due to people born to people who came to this country since 1900 or 1800. With the exception of the First Peoples, all American population growth is the result of births to immigrants, or the children of immigrants, or the grandchildren of immigrants. We are a nation of immigrants. And to pick 1970 as a magic year and to say everybody who was here before 1970 is going to be treated as somebody who, you know, is here of right, and everybody since then, we somehow put their children in a different category? I don't think that's the American tradition. And that's the logic of this analysis, which says all of our population growth is coming from the children of immigrants. I don't think 15-year-old girls, frankly, should be having children. I don't think they should be having children if their parents came over on the Mayflower, and I don't think they should be having children if their parents came here 5 years ago. This is an enormous problem, and I don't think it is taking the eye off the ball to say that the United States can contribute to reducing global overpopulation by bringing down its own excessive rates of teenage and unplanned fertility.
We're talking to Carl Pope, executive director of the Sierra Club. He represents the position of the board of directors of the Sierra Club to vote against a resolution that's been proposed by a group of Sierra Club members. By the way, among those who support this bill are Randy Hayes of the Rainforest Action Network, Dave Foreman of Earth First, Alan Cooper, our guest now, retired professor of engineering at Case Western Reserve University, longtime member of the Sierra Club. Alan Cooper, I wanted you to respond to a piece I just read in Slingshot, which is a Berkeley, California newspaper describing the whole debate. And it says, what exactly is wrong with the way population is discussed among environmentalists today? Perhaps most important is that the debate focuses almost exclusively on absolute numbers of people, ignoring the varying environmental impacts of different social institutions and classes. Alarmist charts and graphs displaying an out-of-control population explosion replace researched analysis on exactly which people where are affecting the environment and how. The impact of an immigrant family, for example, living in a one-bedroom apartment and using mass transportation pales in comparison to a wealthy family living in a single-family home with two cars. And then it quotes Walden Bellow, who is the former executive director of Food First, who says the average Swiss pours 2,000 times more toxic waste into the environment than the average Sahelian farmer. And it goes on from there. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, you can't have it both ways. When people come here, we want them to succeed. All the stories are about how hardworking and plucky people are. They become part of the statistics, and you look at the total numbers. On average, you find that the the one way of looking at it is the GNP per capita in this country, and that takes into account everything. It's $27,000. That's 24 times the world average. So that's why I said earlier that if you're going to do something about the problem of world population, start with the United States. We have the largest impact. We have the largest footprint all over the world. We take resources from everywhere, and we will go to war if we have to. And I mean, it's a terrible thing. It's a responsibility and that sort of thing that each of us has. You know, when Carl talks about the corporations and their activities in other countries, first of all, to say that drives people to come here, only a tiny fraction ever will come here, and those are some of the people who would be the forces of change in their own country. You know, we talk about the brain drain. We're not doing them a favor. But the idea of, I mean, that's exactly what we're saying. Our high numbers and high consumption per capita means that we will have this huge footprint all over the world. which none of us want to have. We would like to live sustainably, and we could have done that with a population of less than 100 million. Now it's almost 300 million, and as I say, doubling. We're going to have numbers. We're already number three after China and India. It's unbelievable. A quarter billion. We're over a quarter billion. We will have numbers when we double, if we continue on this path, like India in 1970. I mean, just try and imagine what that means, because when we do it, it's such a much heavier footprint on the world and all the building of interstates and so on that they don't have.
Alan Cooper, I'd like to interrupt you for 1 second. I'm not quite sure if you answered the question that Amy asked you in terms of the
of
the class basis of some of the environmental degradation that we create. But I'd like to ask you one other question. How do you respond to the charges by some that especially some of the company that you're keeping in terms of this population control, groups like the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and especially John Tanton, who's got a really checkered, to say to the best of him, reputation in terms of the movement for U.S. English. The San Jose Mercury, for instance, quoted Tanton back in 86 in a memo that he had written saying, quote, "As whites see their power and control over their lives declining, will they simply go quietly into the night, or will there be an explosion? The Sierra Club may not want to touch the immigration issue, but the immigration issue is going to touch the Sierra Club." Tanton wrote that in 86.
Tanton being the founder of FAIR.
Yes, the founder
US
of U.S. English. These folks are clearly seen by many in the third world communities of the United States as racist. Differentiate what you're doing within the Sierra Club from what they're doing?
Well, there are a number of points there. One is when you say the people of color or the recently arrived immigrants who are now going to be permanent residents, so we're really talking about all of us together and our children. If you make a survey of the people who are working their way up or who are stuck in the low-skilled jobs, they do not want the population of the United States to grow. And in the Roper poll in 1966, 83% of all Americans across classes surveyed said they favored lower levels of immigration. And you can see why. The fellow that arrives next, this is where you see the forces of greed keeping the wages down for poor people and often people of color. But we're talking about environment, and we want to tell the story to the public so the public will say, gee, I didn't know that. You mean our population is on the way to doubling? Why are we doing this? We see the effect of it. We see, and we want to talk about natural limits which exist, which people really don't think about, because we cover that up. In other parts of the world, if they're trashing their environment as we are ours, they feel it immediately.
Carl Pope, we're going to give you the last word. We do have to wrap up this discussion. To respond to Alan Cooper and then to tell us what the process is for people who are voting now, who are Sierra Club members, what it is that they're actually voting on when they vote for A or B. I understand that that's the way it's put.
Well, to get to that first, if you believe that you should take the Sierra Club's energy and put it into dealing with what we believe is a symptom of our global environmental and population problems, that is, say, let's put a wall around the United States, let's limit immigration, and let's say to the rest of the world, we're going to continue to consume in an unsustainable way. We're not going to bring down our excessively high rates of unplanned and teenage fertility.
Of course, we never said any of that.
We're going to limit how many people come here. That's what the policy focuses us on. And while we have been having this dialogue within the Sierra Club, the right wing in the U.S. Congress has been preparing to dismantle American support for global family planning programs, which provide family planning services to over 100 million families around the world. And in some of the internal discussion, I said to one of Alan's colleagues and supporters, I said, why are we spending our time talking about this while the Congress is voting today? They voted earlier this week, and fortunately we beat them back, to dismantle the global family planning effort. And he said, oh, I don't pay very much attention to that. The fact is, this dialogue is distracting the Sierra Club from dealing with the real problem.
Carl, we have 10 seconds, so
and
when people vote.
And if you believe we should get back to focusing on the root causes, please vote, and please vote for Alternative B. That's the proposal that will focus the Sierra Club's energy on the causes of our environmental and population problems.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Alan Cooper, Chair of the Population and Environment Committee of the Ohio Chapter of the Sierra Club, one of the members who has put forward this resolution to limit immigration into the United States. And we'd like to hear from you on this issue. You can leave a message for us at 212-564-7702 about how you feel. That's 212-564-7702. And if you're a member, vote. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at Jericho 98, a major march in Washington for tomorrow. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Tomorrow, people from across the country will be marching in Washington, D.C. to demand the release of more than 100 political prisoners incarcerated in prisons all across the United States. The Jericho 98 march is expected to be one of the largest demonstrations on behalf of political prisoners in this country. Prisoners who range from Puerto Rican independence activists and fighters for black liberation to members of the American Indian Movement and peace activists. Among those who will be speaking are Dave Dellinger. He is one of the defendants in the Chicago conspiracy trial, also known as the Chicago 8 trial, following the demonstrations at the Democratic Convention of 1968. He was first imprisoned for resisting the draft in World War II and has been to jail more than 100 times. He was most recently arrested at the Justice Department in the campaign to free Native American political prisoner Leonard Peltier. He'll be speaking tomorrow at the march. Let's begin with you, David Dellinger, and how you define.
Amy.
Hi, good to be with you as we speak to you from your home in Vermont. How do you define political prisoner?
Well, I think there's such a variety of them that people who are fighting for the rights of their own people or are fighting against the wars that the United States is imposing on other countries. And then I actually would include some who are not conventionally called political prisoners. When I think of the fact that in 1997, 75 to 85% of the prisoners in the United States had incomes of less than $7,000 a year. And one-third of the prisoners were unemployed the year before imprisonment. And then you take black people who were fighting for their rights. 5 grains of crack can cause them to get 5 years, but for well-to-do people, it takes 500 grains of powder cocaine to get the same amount. So they're victims of the racial, quote, superiority of non-whites, non-blacks and so forth, non-Latinos, non-Puerto Ricans. Just think that on July 25th of this year will be the 100th anniversary of the invasion of Puerto Rico by the United States, and a lot of the prisoners are fighting for Puerto Rican freedom and independence.
Well, in fact, we are joined by Josefina Rodriguez, who is a member of the National Committee to Free Puerto Rican Prisoners of War.
Oh, good, because I'm involved in that, too.
She's the mother of two Puerto Rican political prisoners, Ida Luz Rodriguez and Alicia Rodriguez, who are currently serving more than 80 years on charges of seditious conspiracy.
Yes, well, I think of Carmen Valentin, who was sentenced to 98 years for the same thing.
Josefina Rodriguez, I would like to ask you to give us your reason why you think this march is so important for people to participate in from around the country.
Okay. First, let me tell you, the National Committee to Free Puerto Rican Prisoners of War and Political Prisoners, with the headquarters in Chicago and chapters in Cleveland, Orlando, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, has advocated for the release of Puerto Rican and other political prisoners for close to 30 years. It was formed in 1980 at the time of the Evanston, Illinois arrest, and it comes back from the committee dating back to the early 70s. The committee to free the five nationalists and one from the late 70s, and the committee in defense of Guillermo Morales. The National Committee had grew during a period of time when nobody dared to deal with a prisoner of war position and indeed attacked as an ultra-leftist. It has the National Committee has survived constant attacks by the FBI and other forces who are committed to see these prisoners remain behind bars. And it becomes obvious that our work, particularly in Chicago, comes from the attack of the FBI and its notorious COINTELPRO tactics. Some choose to join in the attacks of the enemy, echoing the state's own attacks on our work, while they claim our accomplishment as their own. We will march forward, joining other seasoned individuals and organizations, and to Washington tomorrow. And we're going to demand freedom for all political prisoners, natives, blacks, whites, anti-imperialists, and our Puerto Rican POWs and prisoners of war. So I have a lot of hope that tomorrow, what is my hope, that Jericho 98 will be the first step towards bringing down the walls of this conspiracy of silence and inactivity around legitimate human rights issues and the struggle for national independence right here in the United States.
Josefina Rodriguez speaks to us from Chicago, Dave Dellinger from Vermont. We're also joined by Kazi Touré, who joins us from Boston. He is the Boston coordinator for the Jericho 98 March. A former prisoner was the first African-American to be convicted of seditious conspiracy in the United States. He served nearly 10 years in prison. Can you explain that conviction, seditious conspiracy, Kazi Touré?
Well, seditious conspiracy is a law that says you don't have to have done anything. You don't have to have committed any overt act. It's if you say anything or write anything, just writing or speaking, and some people go out and do something, then you can be charged with seditious conspiracy. That's the law.
And what was the Ohio 7 trial that you were a part of?
Well, it was really Ohio 8, similar to the Dillinger trial in Chicago, of Chicago 8, where one person was separated and became Chicago 7. And it, ironically, ours became Ohio 7. But there was 8 people involved. And it was a trial of 14 bombings in solidarity with independence movements around the country, around the world. Things that were going on in Puerto Rico and in El Salvador and South Africa, to ending apartheid in South Africa. The actions were taken in solidarity of those liberation movements and solidarity with the people of those countries.
Well, you know, it's ironic that the United States so often condemns other governments for the holding of political prisoners. For instance, you hear often about political prisoners in China and in Iraq and in other countries, yet it refuses to recognize that it has any political prisoners in this country. Why do you think that insistence and apparently the failure by many people in the United States to recognize that there are people that are jailed because of their political beliefs in this country? Josefina Rodriguez and Dave Dellinger, could you?
Well, recently, like you said, the United States government called for the release of political prisoners in respect for human rights in China, and Pope John Paul II did likewise during his trip to Cuba. What are the voices in support of these sacred and most cherished principles in the United States of America? Why do world leaders come to the U.S. and denounce these crimes against its own citizens, which have resulted in incarceration of hundreds of political prisoners, and demand their release? It is rather ironic that during the 1960s and 70s, the human rights struggles here in the United States were just as popular as the national liberation struggles throughout the world. But today, the struggle has been effectively neutralized, and in some cases destroyed by the U.S., you know, the FBI, the COINTELPRO, and it's unbelievable that the Puerto Ricans have to be serving these long, long sentences just for because the Puerto Rican wants our country to be free.
Juan, you did an interesting piece a while ago looking at the Puerto Rican independence activists who are in prison and the sentences they got for conspiracy, comparing them to other cases.
Yes. Clearly, in many cases, even, for instance, many people who have been convicted of abortion bombings or what the government calls terrorist acts from the, especially if they are from the right, have gotten far lower sentences. And many people who have been convicted of murder in the United States have gotten far lower sentences than the Puerto Rican political prisoners around the United States, and many of the African American political prisoners, which I think goes back to what Dellinger was saying at the very beginning. Dave Dellinger, could you talk about that, about the refusal of the country to recognize political prisoners and this disproportionate sentencing?
Yeah, well, I think of the case of Leonard Peltier, who actually has two consecutive life sentences and has been in jail for more than 22 years for something which began with the FBI acting illegally and invading the Pine Ridge Reservation. The FBI and the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which means, you know, the government, were anxious to do away with traditional Indian values and lifestyles, in part because they wanted part of the reservation to be used by a corporation to mine uranium, which is another, of course, connected with another crime. But at the time that AIM was called in to help protect the traditional Indians, there had been over 100 FBI-assisted murders in order to accomplish, destroying the Indian way of life and mining uranium. And on June 16, 1975, the FBI opened fire on, invaded, and opened fire on the AIM camp in Oglala, South Dakota. And during the resulting firefight, one Native American and two FBI agents were killed. But no one has ever been charged with the death of the Native. But an all-white jury in North Dakota refused to allow the prosecutor refused to allow the self-defense plea. And now the prosecutor in that case actually says that we have no idea who really committed the crime. And now the FBI has been exposed to having withheld the evidence that would have proved Peltier's innocence. So the government is involved in creating the situation which leads to their arrest, then no wonder the government doesn't want to call them political prisoners.
And yet, when you look at the Ruby Ridge situation, where there was, in essence, a right-wing group involved, there was a far different response, both on the part of the government and in a large measure in the public around the United States in terms of sympathy for it. I often try to compare the situations of what happened, for instance, with the MOVE bombing and massacre in Philadelphia versus what happened in Waco, where there was widespread public sympathy for the victims of Waco, but almost no sympathy for the adults and the children who died in Philadelphia in the MOVE massacre.
In fact, Kazi Ture, Pam and Ramon Africa will be speaking at tomorrow's march, Jericho 98.
Can I say something? I think also the United States, the reason why it refuses to recognize that it has political prisoners is they don't want to give the people of this country anything but we got people incarcerated for, like, robbery or hoodie. They portray, you know, black youth and Latino youth on TV and negative images to demonize certain population, and they don't want these people to see that they have heroes, working class heroes that are fighting against injustice. Is a criminal system. This is a criminal government. Just what Dave Dillinger was explaining about what happened to Leonard. They do criminal acts against people, and then charge people that resist that with a criminal activity, and they're the criminals.
Kazi Ture, Jericho 98, how'd you come up with that title of the march as one of the coordinators of this event tomorrow in Washington?
Well, the call came from political prisoners inside, and they named it Jericho, and I think it came from, the not only the biblical expression of tear down the walls of Jericho, but I think it was something that was formulated years before but never came together. And this is the first time in the country's history that we've been able to, you know, have a march for political prisoners and prisoners of war in this country to expose that hypocrisy.
Well, we have a phone number for people if they're interested in finding out about the march that's taking place tomorrow in Washington, D.C. The number is 212-473-4257. That's 212-473-4257. And the website is http://jericho98.togdog.com. That's jericho98.togdog.com. Among the people who will be speaking, the Africas, Ramona and Pam Africa, Dave Dellinger, you're going down from Vermont. Kazi Ture, who else will be there tomorrow?
Chokwe Lumumba, from New African People's Organization, Daruba Ben Wahad, Angela Davis, Josefina, who you have, Lennox Hines.
Attorney.
Yes, and Minister Benjamin Muhammad Ben Chavis, Kathleen Cleaver, Dennis Banks.
Well, that's a partial list, and we're going to have to leave it at that. We will let
Geronimo
people know.
Too.
Geronimo Pratt as well. I want to thank you all for joining us. Josefina Rodriguez, member of the National Committee to Free Puerto Rican Prisoners of War in Chicago, Kazi Ture, Boston coordinator for the Jericho 98 March, and Dave Dellinger speaking to us from Vermont, one of the defendants in the Chicago conspiracy trial in jail for more than 100 times for his various actions. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our director, Jeremy Scahill, Michael G. Haskins, our engineer, Julie Drizin, our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!